You get to go first.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, this is a case about information. Information that is clearly and admittedly true. Vendors of alcoholic beverages would like to convey that information in advertisements. Broadcasters would like to broadcast those advertisements to the public. And the public would benefit from receiving that information because consumers do better when they have more information. Consumers are going to be buying alcoholic beverages. That's something that happens in our society. They'd like to know the best price. If they have the best price, they can make wiser decisions. Most likely, they'll be saving money. They'll have money in their extra money in their pockets to have coffee with friends or save for their kids' college education or take a trip to Branson or the Bahamas. But consumers can make better decisions with truthful information. And yet, in this case, truthful information is being withheld from them. It's an exception. As Justice Powell mentioned many years ago in the Bates case, advertisements containing truthful information play an indispensable role in the allocation of resources in a free enterprise society. So, three Missouri laws are interfering with this indispensable role of getting more information out. We believe those laws are clearly unconstitutional, and the district court ruling which upheld them should be reversed. We have three reasons why the district court should be reversed. First, we believe it's absolutely clear under the Central Hudson case, the 44 Liquor Mart case, and all the precedents on commercial speech that this is an unconstitutional infringement of commercial speech. Second, we believe that the Sorrell versus IMS Health case, which sets a heightened standard, sets a much higher standard, whereas here you have a content-based abridgment of free speech, and these laws can definitely not survive Sorrell. And the third reason, which is even the most basic I'd like to address first, which is that this was before the court on plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. The record was simply the motion that we as plaintiffs put together, what we thought was the key facts, the undisputed issues, no genuine issues of material fact, for summary judgment for us. And yet Judge Gaetan not only denied our motion, but essentially entered summary judgment against us, entered judgment against us. Judge Gaetan said that he was going back and looking at a previously denied motion to dismiss, but really that motion to dismiss did not even raise the grounds he relied on. The court did not give us opportunity, notice that it was reconsidering Judge Wright's denial of the motion to dismiss, did not give us the opportunity to respond, we had no notice of the grounds on which the judge was going to grant the dismissal. And I think really it was probably a feeling that on the merits he felt the defendant should win, but it was a wrong procedural posture. The defendants cannot win on a record of plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. So at the most basic level, the dismissal was improper and there should at least be a remand so the case can be decided on a full record, not a simply plaintiff's summary judgment record.
What more record would there need to be?
Well, there's a fair amount, Judge Riley, that we could put in to show, for example, the inconsistencies. And inconsistencies have been fatal to most of the major commercial speech cases. We were able to show a fair number of inconsistencies just by the law, just by looking at what the law allows, all the inconsistencies the law allows. At trial, we could put it on evidence of the actual practice. Let me give you a couple of examples. The largest beer brewer in the United States, Anheuser-Busch, for many years owned Busch Stadium. Busch Stadium was, and this isn't in the record because I can't get it in on summary judgment, Busch Stadium was the largest venue for the retail sale of beer. And so there was this total control by the largest brewer of the largest retail venue. That's a tremendous exception to the three-tier system separating the three tiers of alcoholic beverages that the plaintiffs rely on. There's a lot more examples. We could show, for example, that most breweries, microbreweries in Missouri, operate under micro-winery licenses, which allows them to make unlimited retail sales, although the microbrewery license, which we have in the record, is more limited. Another example, the actual enforcement procedures here and the actual enforcement history. The plaintiffs, the state says, we're trying to prevent binge drinking and aggressive sales practices. In fact, what these regulations reach is what I said earlier, mere information, no possibility of aggressive sales practice. I'd love to show in the record, and we would at trial, one of the advertisements that was litigated vigorously by the state. It's a full-page grocery store advertisement. Contains all the different grocery store things. Way down at the bottom, there's a tiny picture of the cardboard carrier that at Schnucks you can put 6 wine bottles in, and you get a discount if you buy 6 wine bottles at the same time. On that carton is a little starburst that says 15% discount on Wednesdays. On this big page, this little picture of the 6-pack carrier and a little starburst, that was what the state prosecuted. They said that this tiny little starburst on this big page was illegal. Clearly, there's no aggressive sales practice there. Clearly, there's no likelihood of binge drinking because somebody sees this big, this advertisement. So I think there's a lot more we could have put in the record. That being said, when it comes down to it, we think the record is more than sufficient for summary judgment in our favor. There's 3 basic points here that are in all the commercial speech cases. And I'd like to point the Greater New Orleans case, Greater New Orleans Broadcasting, Rubin versus Coors Broadcasting, and 44 Liquormart are the most pertinent ones. In all 3 of those cases, Supreme Court cases, you had a truthful ad being prohibited, ban on truthful statements. You had a great number of inconsistencies in the way the law was applied. In every case, you could get the information in different ways, but it was prohibited in certain ways. It was prohibited in broadcast advertising in casinos, but you could get it somewhere else. It was prohibited on beer labels and Coors, but you could find strength. A bartender could tell you the strength, and there were hints about it. In 44 Liquormart, prices couldn't be advertised, but obviously they were in stores. These inconsistencies were fatal in all these cases. And the third thing that all 3 of these cases had was paternalism. The whole point of the law was to keep information from the public because the state didn't like what the public would do if they had the information. And the U.S. Supreme Court has been so strong against paternalism. There's about 20 quotes. I don't have time to quote them all, but Justice Stevens in Rubin versus Coors Brewing said, it's anathema to the First Amendment to restrict the flow of accurate information because of the perceived danger of what people would do with that knowledge.
You said that you thought you were entitled to summary judgment, but that's not what's on appeal here, right? You're not appealing a denial of summary judgment.
Well, because final judgment was entered, that is before the court. Yes, Your Honor. Because judgment...
We're here in a grant of essentially a 12B6, I think.
Well, but I believe, though, the court can look at the entire record. The court has to make an independent examination anyway. This is up on, de novo review because it's a pure legal issue. It's an independent examination of the record because of First Amendment interest. This just goes back to New York Times versus Sullivan and a whole slew of cases. And I believe the court can examine the entire record, including the denial of summary judgment, and can direct entry of summary judgment.
What relief are you looking for if we were to reverse the district court's grant of dismissal, and I think it was 12B6, what happens next?
Well, I think if that were the case, then it would go to trial, and we could certainly do that. I think, though, that the denial of summary judgment is part of the record and is something that can be reversed.
But that's not appealable.
Well, it's the entire judgment. Well, all right, so I guess what...
Just talk generically, it's not appealable.
I see. Well, I think the court could certainly give... its own judgment as to the facts in the case. Certainly in assessing the 12B6 motion, the court is going to look at everything, including the entire record. The court can certainly give directions as to what it feels are the proper elements of a Central Hudson case and whether these seem to have been satisfied by that. I certainly hope that we don't have a futility of kind of having a remand, having a trial, and start all over again. We have a pretty full record here that we can tell what the situation is. I don't think the record here is any different, really, than the record in most of the classic commercial speech cases, Central Hudson, 44 Liquormart, et cetera.
Well, One thing in ancient history, when I was trying cases, sometimes we ended up with a summary judgment and just told the court, consider that the trial. That wasn't done.
No.
Done here, so
no, absolutely.
We are on a 12B6 dismissal. We're not, you know, the parties have not just agreed, okay, just take the evidence and consider that the case.
No, and that wouldn't be fair to us, Your Honor, because as I say, there's significant more evidence we could put in that would be very, you know, powerful, is even greater on the inconsistencies that are fatal to these laws. I think the procedural issue is a problem. I'd still like to talk about the merits, if I may. Because,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, we have an incredibly strong case, I think, on Central Hudson. You've got every element, the truthful statements, the great deals of inconsistencies in how they're handled, which means they can't meet the reasonable advancement issue or the narrow fit.
You're speaking to the regulations at this point.
Well, it's true of both the regulations and the statute, Judge Kelly,
Speaking collectively.
Yeah,
they're
different, but in every case there's inconsistencies. There's different inconsistencies with respect to the regulations and different ones with respect to the statute. And in both cases there's an attempt to keep people ignorant for their own good. Well, it's primarily for the regulations. In the case of the statute, is to keep it's to satisfy a different objective, which is economic regulation, which we think is not even a substantial state interest in the first place. That is different with the statute. The state doesn't deny that this is truthful speech, and they really have simply some excuses. They say, well, we only prohibit half as much speech as 44 Liquor Mart, but any prohibition of truthful speech is a problem. The partial bans are a problem because they are so inconsistent. For example, in Greater New Orleans, there was this thing that said, well, they can hint about it being a casino, but they can't say it outright. Same way here, the state says they can hint about happy hours, but they can't say the discounts outright. The court says those are fatal inconsistencies.
So it's clear that it's undisputed that the state permits the happy hours, the specials, those sorts of things.
I don't know about that. I've had to interpret these for years to clients, and I've never thought that it was an exception for happy hours. It says you may not advertise discounts. I tell clients you can't do something directly, you can't do something indirectly. The state said this in its brief, but I don't think that I would rely. I don't think it's a reliable a statement. They're not committed to that. Maybe they are, but. I don't know, but that's a troubling thing. But there's so many other inconsistencies as well. You know, that, for example, they allow you can advertise coupons for spirits, but not other things, and so on. Their primary excuse is this Coe study, but the Coe study is totally unlike this. The Coe study studied 46 attributes of liquor stores and bars and restaurants near college campuses. None of those attributes relate to media advertising. So there's no evidence of media advertising furthering binge drinking.
So if this went back, the state would have an opportunity to put on additional evidence as well.
Sure, absolutely.
Unless
the court looked at the record here and said the record here is overwhelming in favor of the plaintiffs, as we believe it is. The common sense justification, I think it's clear in the record that doesn't work. I think we should also look at the policy issues here. If we are going to be discouraging people from doing things by keeping truthful information, there's going to be a lot of problems down the road. Do we want to keep information about soda from people because we think it's going to cause obesity? Do we want to keep information about video games from people because we think video games are bad? In all these situations, there are narrower ways to regulate. You can cut out the vending machines for soda in high schools. You can put labels on video games. You can have warnings and educational campaign and enforcement and regulations in college areas to combat binge drinking. So there's so much better ways to do things than to infringe speech.
And so, if I understand, at least as to the regulations, the stated interest is to reduce irresponsible drinking, right? Not to reduce
right.
drinking across the marketplace.
Right.
And is that that's agreed.
We agreed that's a substantial interest.
And the state, I guess I shouldn't be asking you, but the state, that's not in dispute what the state interest is.
No, no.
That it's that more narrow,
right? Absolutely.
Responsible drinking concern.
But even for a narrow issue, they have to have reasonable advancement, close fit, and they have to have narrow tailoring. And when you're allowing somebody in arm's reach of a bartender to say, I want a $1 pitcher in a college, and you're allowing all that, but you're simply not allowing the ad to reach somebody sitting in their apartment at Country Club Plaza, that's so inconsistent that there's no direct advancement or narrow tailoring. I'd like to save my rebuttal time, so I'll sit down now.
Okay, you may. Good morning, Mr. President.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. In reviewing the decision of the District Court, I believe there are several essential matters to keep in mind. First and foremost is, what is the decision here? The decision was, one, a denial of their motion for summary judgment, and in the course of that order, a reconsideration of an earlier motion the state had filed to dismiss for failure to state a claim.
Well, do you agree that a denial of a motion for summary judgment is not appealable?
In general, I agree with you, and I was a little confused by this here. I have heard the same argument that counsel has, that once a case gets before the court, then it can consider any issue. Now, whether that applies to a summary judgment, I just wasn't sure. But I noted the question in my brief that if it was appealable, there isn't a certain cases like qualified immunity certainly are appealable. What the standard was, but I noted that there was a question.
Do you know of any authority where, similar to this, where a denial of summary judgment, you've had a then sua sponte or just on merits, 12B6 dismissal, and then the appellate court has also looked at the summary judgment?
No. In that situation, no, I don't. There are cases, and I cited a couple of them, indicating that certainly a denial of a motion for dismissal is an interlocutory order, and before final judgment, that can always be reconsidered. The court has the inherent authority to do that. And quite apart from the court's inherent authority, if you go back and you look at the order denying our original summary judgment, really, the judge did not deny our arguments on the merit, but he just said, I think it might be more appropriate later in the proceedings at a summary judgment stage to consider these arguments. So I think the district court, after denying the summary judgment, had the inherent right to do that, to reconsider and to now grant the dismissal. But the problem here is their brief, in many respects, says the state needs to meet this burden and that burden. It's as if they thought there was a trial on the merits, which I think we can all agree there was not. This was not a situation where we even filed a cross motion for summary judgment. This was not a situation where we agreed to submit the case to the court on an agreed record in which the court could actually make its findings. So much of the plaintiff's brief is actually talking about whether the state met its burden without any real discussion as to whether it met its burden, first on their summary judgment, assuming that is properly before the court, and then what their burden was in order to plead a viable cause of action in this case, which leads us to the second really essential matter, and that is, this is a facial challenge. The plaintiff has brought up some additional instances of schnooks. Of course, they don't represent schnooks and probably wouldn't have standing, but, you know, this is not an as-applied challenge. The court recognized below, and they really haven't established otherwise, that this was a facial challenge. Now, this is, I think we can all agree, a very, very stringent standard for a facial challenge. This court has indicated that it is incumbent then upon a person making a facial challenge to show that a statute or regulation, whatever area of law it is incapable of any valid application. And that's the standard they must meet and to state a viable cause of action here. Now, in terms of what the law is in the area of commercial speech, they have argued that, you know, Central Hudson case of the U.S. Supreme Court has been superseded. I think that has been generally rejected by most courts which have considered it, and I believe this court as well, which said we still are going to follow Central Hudson, and I think that's appropriate, and that's what the district court below did. But the course of that, we have to recognize that, again, the court said we in Central Hudson said we recognize there's a common sense distinction between commercial speech and other forms of speech, such as political speech. And we recognize that there are some restrictions permissible on commercial speech, including restrictions on some forms of aggressive sales practices. They have reiterated that in later cases, but I think that is the general guideline that we must apply in this situation. And it is a situation which the plaintiffs simply do not acknowledge. They say, we actually should be promoting more information.
Explain to me why there's the categorization here when you're trying to control marketed alcohol and limited to some degree to limit binge drinking, I think you argue, and so forth. Why? What is the rationale for the inconsistency of treating different liquors, beers, so forth, differently?
Well, let me back up. The binge drinking was just a phrase I think I put in the brief to generally indicate alcohol abuse. I mean, certainly, you know, I accept it.
So you're
I live in a college town, Columbia,
alcohol.
So I knew what binge drinking was all about.
Why would it not regulate all alcohol?
Well, but here's the thing. The Supreme Court has indicated that the broader aspect of the Central Hudson case and later cases is what did it in. They said, you know, there needs to be a narrow definition or a narrow relationship between the state's interest, which they have conceded here, that responsible consumption is a valid and substantial state interest, and what your regulation is. I have always been struck by their attitude, though, towards every provision that they say is creating an inconsistency, which makes the whole thing irrelevant or irrational. I mean, it seems to me the state has attempted to make it narrow to its interest. This narrow approach here.
Well, I understand it is narrow, but I'm trying. But your reasoning for doing it is broad. You're saying we're trying to limit the use of alcohol.
Not in general, not across the board. I mean, it's responsible consumption. We, unlike the state of Rhode Island,
how do you regulate certain alcoholic drinks and not others, and
well,
that somehow
maybe I don't understand what their argument was, but maybe you could give me an example of what you mean, why we're regulating some alcohol and not the other.
Well, it's content based. You're talking about discounts and coupons. You're talking about speakers, intoxicating liquor, and non-intoxicating beer retailers, right?
We don't have separate licenses for 3-2 beer anymore, but we are talking, though, about the advertisement for alcoholic beverages, and there may be, one small exception for rebates for spirits, because they were complaining that they couldn't compete with other producers who were being allowed to offer rebates in other states.
The argument is when you're in a free speech, this is not a typical regulatory thing. You're talking about free speech. So the question is, are you treating everybody equally? Does everybody have the same right to speech?
Yes, I think so.
I mean, it's kind of odd. We're talking about regulating a business, but we're talking about free speech.
Well, we aren't really regulating the business. They're the ones who keep saying we need to regulate the business, and they're saying that would be more appropriate. If they're saying that we ought to prohibit the sale of alcohol entirely, or that we just ought to do away with all price discounting, I mean, they're the ones who are saying we should be regulating the business practices. But the state has not chosen that approach, and I frankly don't think that would be a very It wouldn't be an approach that would actually serve the state's interest.
What you mentioned, you said, well, the hard liquor, there were some complaints. They needed to compete with out-of-state sellers. Why is that not treating them differently than other folks in the alcohol industry?
I don't want to get too, you know, this was exactly the situation that Judge Gaitan asked for further briefing on. And we both addressed this. And Judge Gaitan agreed with us that this was not really pled as part of their complaint. This was just something they threw in the argument. So any difference, you know, that they want to make about that, you know, is really not within the confines of this complaint.
Well, what about is it true that happy hours, specials, ladies' nights, that those are okay? Those aren't banned by the regulations?
That was one of the first things the Division of Liquor Control told me when I got this case.
So how is that? How do you square that with the ultimate goal or the recognized goal of reducing irresponsible drinking when you're okaying an on-site happy hour advertisement where it's 2-for-1, got to drink by 6, as opposed to some of the other kind of coupon advertisements? How do you square that?
I think there are a couple of questions in there. First, the general allowance under the state statute of, or the state regulations, pardon me, that generic descriptions of special or happy hour are permissible. The focus has always been on advertising, which is focusing on the degree of it, the 50% off. That is barred. Now, on site, yes. But putting out in the papers, putting it out on TV or the radio, that's the media advertising which is being regulated.
So it could be a media advertisement saying 50% off happy hour, but it can't be a media advertisement just saying 50% off.
No. You would just have to say, if you put that 50% in.
So you could you say
you could just say happy hour.
Happy hour.
Now that implies that there is some discount, but it's not the focusing, it's not the emphasis on the degree of it as a means of trying to get people in.
So you're saying that the limit on the advertising for happy hour is you can't say what the happy is.
The extent of it, let's put it that way. I think this is exactly what the Supreme Court talked about in the Rubin case. They said there they were talking about a regulation of whether you could list the strength of malt liquor on the label. And the stated purpose was to prevent strength wars, where various brewers were basically trying to promote their product. We're stronger than our competitors, you know. They acknowledged that that was a legitimate interest, but the total ban on putting it in the label restriction was too broad for the Supreme Court. They suggested that there would be a narrower way to address this by restricting advertising, which focused on the strength as a means of selling product. And I think that's what we're doing here. We're trying to focus on the degree, the extent of the deal. You know, saying you've got, you know, $1 a pitcher, you know, or buy 4, get 1 free. You know, I mean, you know, it's those that they are trying to limit the effect of those. I mean, it's also sort of the thing that Judge Alito, when he was on the Third Circuit, said in the Pitt case, he said if he thought the statute would actually limit the amount of liquor ads that Pitt students saw, he would say, yeah, the standard had been met. But since the regulation there at issue applied only to the student newspaper, not to other papers, not to radio, not to TV, it was so under-inclusive that there was not that logical connection. But here, the Supreme Court has said we recognize the connection between advertising and demand. And when you focus on particular aspects like the strength or other things, you know, you're trying to beef up your demand. Now, we are not like Rhode Island trying to limit or reduce consumption. Overall, the state has a significant interest, economic, in the liquor industry, as Anheuser-Busch is. As plaintiff mentions, as well as the wineries and microbreweries that are so popular these days. This is something that is a significant part of the state's economy. So it's not the overall consumption, like in Rhode Island, we were trying to limit, but we are trying to promote responsible consumption. And that means that we don't, you know, if people have a budget.
Why is it okay to have in-house promotions but not advertised promotions?
Well, they will.
One differ in your...
Well, you're already in the place, for one thing.
Pardon me?
You're already in the establishment. I mean, you know, the thing is, you
well,
it seems
important to limit it when they're there than when you're reading it in the newspaper.
Well, once you're in the establishment, they can advertise their price. Their regular price, anyway, even in ads, you know, so much for a six pack. You know, I mean, if that's their regular price, they can even advertise that. But if they want to say, you know, half price on a 12 pack or whatever, that's where the regulation would apply. But I keep having a problem with saying, well, what's the difference, and why shouldn't we also regulate, you know, in-house ads? Because actually that winds up being broader. When the Supreme Court has cautioned us that we should be narrowly tailoring what our regulation is, I just find this inherent inconsistency. I saw it all through the plaintiff's brief that they were kept saying, you know how to take all these other, you know, possibilities, you know, totally ban the sale of alcohol then. You know, I somewhat facetiously suggested, that's like curing an ingrown toenail by amputating your foot. I mean, you know, I don't see that being broader and regulating more is actually, you know, a solution here. I think what the state has attempted to do, and they've done this for decades, because this policy of limiting only, you know, ads which focus on the degree of price and do not prohibit, like, saying a special or a happy hour or whatever, that dates back to the 70s. But it has always been to not drag people in or draw people in. And you know, in as I say, I come from a college town, so, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with this. I mean, you get into to a bar, you know, or you go to a bar because they had an ad. It's possible, you know. I mean, you want to avoid that. You know, if you've got a budget, and you know, oh, at this place, we can buy twice as much alcohol for our budgeted amount here. You know, I have a feeling, you know, I know a lot of people that would actually take advantage of that. And that's what they want to try to avoid here.
And I'd like you to address the procedural posture a little bit. Say that we did affirm. What would we be affirming? Did the district court look at material outside the pleadings to grant this motion to dismiss?
I don't believe so. I thought, you know, I viewed this as
why not?
I viewed this as a motion to dismiss. As I said, pointed out, we have to keep in mind this is a facial challenge. Now, what is it they have to prove, or to at least allege, to state a facial challenge? Some basis, factually, legally, to show that there are no circumstances under which this regulation would be valid. That's what the standard for being a facial challenge is. And since the Supreme Court has legally said, you know, there are not the same sorts of restrictions on commercial speech that we have on political speech, we do allow some regulation of the content of advertising used to promote a particular product or not. And so when we recognize that this is what the Supreme Court has given, and I think anybody who at the time those decisions came down looked at the Missouri statutes, they would say, well, gee, we're in line with what the Supreme Court has said. They haven't alleged or invoked any principle of law or any facts which would indicate that they were entitled to a total ban on the enforcement of these regulations. I mean, they only talk really about the price aspect of it, but, you know, this also has coupons, prizes, other promotions. You know, it's things that are designed to get people in and buy more. they themselves acknowledge in their brief that rebates, you know, have a tendency to lure people in to buy more, but then they don't get it because they don't redeem the rebate or the coupon or whatever. So there is a connection here, and they haven't shown, I think, under the law, Central Hudson and all its progeny, that there is no way that this is not incapable of a valid application. I think it has a plainly legitimate sweep, and I think the district court correctly realized that, and as a result, they did not state a viable claim for a facial challenge to these regulations or this statute. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Sable?
I'd like to correct a few things at the outset. The state does have the burden. I refer to State University of New York versus Fox. Justice Scalia said at page 480, the state bears the burden on prongs 2, 3, and 4 of Central Hudson, and it must affirmatively establish the reasonable fit would require. As far as this idea that there is that this is a facial challenge and we have to prove it's incapable of any valid application, that's simply not the law. Counsel was quoting U.S. versus Salerno. Salerno does not apply in the First Amendment context. I refer you to Ada versus Guam Society of Obstetricians, 506 U.S. 1011. Justice Scalia said that. He cited other cases. There's a 11th Circuit case, United States versus Fransden, 212 Fed 3rd, 1231. Salerno is totally inapposite in the First Amendment. In the First Amendment area, we actually have the opposite of Salerno. We have the overbreath doctrine, which does allow someone outside the sphere of interest to challenge a statute facially on grounds of overbreath. But that doesn't matter. We're not outside the sphere of influence. I have a little drawing here, Your Honors. Here's a law on an as-applied thing, where the plaintiff's conduct is only part of what the law covers. That's an as-applied challenge. Here's an overbreath challenge or a Salerno challenge. Salerno is for vagueness, where the plaintiff is outside the scope of the law. That doesn't apply in the First Amendment. In the First Amendment area, there's an overbreath, so someone outside the scope of the law can challenge it. But none of that matters because we are totally within the scope of the law. We're challenging because everything in this law applies to us. The law applies to vendors, which are my clients, and advertisers, which advertising media, which are my client. So we're challenging as applied to us. We're not making a facial attack from outside the scope of it. And we're exactly the same way that the court situation was in 44 Liquor Mart, in Laura Lard, in a number of other cases. We cite them in footnote 3 of our reply brief. Next, let's get back to the merits for 1 minute. It's not just the Central Hudson test. It's also the Sorrell test. I was there for the Supreme Court argument in Sorrell 5 years ago. It was an impressive sight. This court really cares about protecting content and not allowing content-based regulations. Sorrell, I believe, set a strict scrutiny standard. I'd like to walk through that just very quickly. Part 2A of Sorrell is a strict scrutiny analysis, analyzes all sorts of classic Supreme Court cases like New York Times versus Sullivan, Ward versus Rockins, racism, RAV, all classic First Amendment cases. Justice Kennedy says, this statute can't survive strict scrutiny. Then in part, so it's suggesting that is the new standard. Then 2B, it says, but it doesn't matter because it also couldn't meet the Central Hudson standard. A few years later, in Reed versus Town of Gilbert, Justice Thomas, a very big decision, said all content-based regulations are subject to strict scrutiny. Justice Breyer, in concurrence, refers to the heightened strict scrutiny standard set by Sorrell. And that's a quote. Plus, Sorrell applies here too, and Sorrell has this very strong standard. You've got to be a compelling state interest, and there has to be narrow tailoring. You know, as Justice Thomas said in Reed versus Town of Gilbert, where they allowed all sorts of exceptions, the statute was hopelessly under-inclusive and therefore not narrowly tailored. As Judge Riley points out, this is incredibly under-inclusive because it allows face-to-face advertising promotion of these discounts right when the possibility of binge drinking is the greatest. Yes, give me that $1 pitcher. Yes, I'll take that 2-for-1. Do you want more for just a dollar? That's where the problem is, and the statute doesn't cover that. It's clearly under-inclusive, could not meet Sorrell. Finally, would it be Would the court appreciate a supplemental brief on the jurisdictional point that you raise? If so, we'd be happy to help if that would help.
Well, let us think about it. We haven't discussed it. But if we do, we'll ask counsel to file a supplemental briefing on it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Judge.
Okay. Thank you both. Very interesting case, and obviously an important case for the state of Missouri, the people of Missouri, and the plaintiffs here. We'll take it under advisement and be back to you as soon as we can.
Thank you.
Thank you both.